Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray, sponsored by Cybertrust.
Hello and welcome to another edition of A Risky Business here on itradio.com.au with me, Patrick Gray. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast using the links to the left of the main posts. And if you're interested in networking and systems integration, don't forget to tune in to our weekly networking podcast, A Series of Tubes with Ian Yates. That one updates every Wednesday here on itradio.com.au. On today's show, we'll talk to former Microsoft and eBay security chief Howard Schmidt. We'll check in with Paul Nevin from our sponsor Cybertrust to discuss forensics, and we'll have a chat to our fine friends over at Auscert about this week's threats. But first, as always, it's time to check in with Munir Katadia at ZDNet Australia for the latest news. Munir, it seemed that I actually got to do one of my favourite things last week and throw a story out there that got a lot of attention.
Oh, mate, your story was all over the place.
It was. It was being paraphrased. It was being ripped off and rewritten by a bunch of different media organisations.
Always means you did a good job.
Yeah. I guess imitation is the best form of flattery, as they say.
Oh, absolutely. Yep.
But yeah, look, as it turned out, some miscreants, as we like to call them, were able to hack into the website for the Sydney Opera House and plant some rather nasty JavaScript into the page.
Yeah, it seems that if you were around looking at their site with an unpatched browser a little while, that was about a month ago or so. Then,
yeah, late May.
Yeah, then there was a good chance that you'd caught something nasty on your machine.
What was really funny about watching this is it was the third or second most read story on smh.com.au that day, okay?
Right.
And really, to people who have worked in security, you know, a web server getting owned and having some JavaScript embedded in it, it's not really a big deal.
No.
So it sort of strikes me that maybe the general public is going through the same educational process that the IT and InfoSec space went through a few years ago.
Well, we can only hope so. I mean, you know, we've been writing about this kind of stuff. I know I have for quite a while now, and there was a few stories that we've done, you know, just over the past few months saying, you know, our trusted websites, they can no longer really be trusted. So it's not a big deal. It happens all the time. But I guess the fact that it's a Sydney Opera House website getting done, you know, that brings in a load of traffic and a load of eyeballs out there.
Yeah, I think 300,000 uniques every month visited that website. But I was quite surprised at the level of interest from, you know, everyday punters. And I was also amazed at the awful rewrite that the guys at did. I mean, it was like they'd just basically taken the SMH story that I wrote and paraphrased it and then put it back up there. But they managed to introduce errors. It's amazing, you know.
They ruined your clean copy, did they?
Oh, they did, you know. And the thing is, they attributed the story to SMH, you know, to the Sydney Morning Herald and all of that. But they really did make some pretty nasty boo-boos. All right, now we've seen a claim from the FBI in the United States that what's his name, Dr. Evil.
Billion.
Yeah, yes. A million zombies have threatened U.S. national security.
The security, the national infrastructure, the economy, they've got it all in there, really. And the funny thing is, though, that they're admitting to a million. I'd like to talk to all the ISPs there and find out how many there really are.
Yeah, well, I mean, it seems, I hate to say it, but it seems almost a conservative estimate because there's a lot of botnets out there. I mean,
you know, we've heard about this for so long now that there are so many botnets out there. But I think the key to this is the ISPs, you know. I mean, they're the ones that know exactly how many botnets are out there. They're seeing all this traffic.
Or they could find out, at the very least.
Well, exactly, if they were willing to spend the money and check it out, and they're the ones that could do something about it. But no, I think you're right. A million is probably a very conservative estimate.
Yeah, and the discovery was made by Operation Bot Roast. Now, say what you want about Americans. They are so much better at naming stuff than us. We're just so unimaginative when it comes to naming stuff. If it was here, it would be, you know, Operation Remotely Controlled Compromised Host. But this is Operation Bot Roast.
I do like that, but I'm glad it's not an acronym.
Yeah. OBR.
Yes.
So, yeah, we'll just, I mean, look, I don't think anyone's going to say that, you know, botnets are going to go anywhere. So I guess we can put that in the kind of interesting kind of maybe you want to believe it, maybe you don't basket.
Well, at least they're admitting there's a million. I guess that's a start.
All right. So Apple released Safari for Windows, was it last week, prompting most people who've ever even used a computer or Safari for that matter to say, Huh? The common consensus seems to be that they've put it out there so that developers using Windows machines can write content that is suited to the iPhone, which is
I think that's pretty much what it's all based around. I think one thing though that needs to be said is that it is only a beta version. So yeah, there are bugs and it has had some issues.
That's the funny part, isn't it? Three patches already.
It's been out for a few days. Well, come on, they're not waiting for a monthly patch cycle or anything like that. In that way, it's pretty good. You know, they were out there, they've put out the patches, they've fixed those issues. I'm sure there's an awful lot more of issues that will come out.
We're talking Apple bugs every week now, you know, and this is this is the thing that everyone said would never happen. Well, not everyone, but, you know, all of the little, you know, Apple flag waving dudes said would never happen. But it seems every week it's like, yep, there's been a 0 day in this, 0 day in that. Yeah. So, yeah.
Are any of these people being exploited? Are they getting exploited? Are there exploits out there for
these? See, not yet, because we've got the attack vectors, but, okay, say I'm a big bad criminal, right?
Yeah.
I can get into all of these Macs pretty bloody easily. And I'd reckon if I had a couple of good researchers, I'd have a few 0 day vulnerabilities, right?
Yeah, I'll go
that. I could sort of see it out there. I don't have the Trojan. That's the problem. I don't have a undetectable, remotely controllable Trojan built for the OS X platform. I mean, I got about 5 or 6 commercial ones, you know, underground commercial ones to pick for Windows, but nothing for Apple. So I think that's why we're not seeing anything exploited yet. But I imagine there's maybe a underground syndicate out there that is putting some attention into creating these sorts of Trojans for Macs, because really, from an underground point of view, it is an untapped market, if you will.
The other thing is, how many of these Macs have little cameras on them? You know, it's like you're going to be able to see these guys as well as just being able to steal their information.
Well, I remember when the internet sort of first became mainstream, I may have known some guys who used to get their kicks by owning people's machines and then speaking to them through their sound cards.
Yeah, that was so common, right? When they
So they'd be chatting to someone in IRC or whatever, somehow get their IP and then just start going, hey, you know, what's going on? So I guess, you know, if you really value your privacy, you'll be sticking a little bit of sticky tape over that iCam. What do they call it? The eyesight. That's
eyesight. Yeah, that's right. I have considered that quite a lot. I'm not quite that paranoid yet, but I reckon I'm pretty close to it.
All right. Now, we've seen another story, a bit of a think piece here, saying that open source malware, there may be more to come.
This, of course, comes to light after a network worm affecting OpenOffice was unleashed on unsuspecting users.
Well, there's a surprise, isn't there?
Well, you know, I mean, I guess that reaction, you know, is a fairly elementary one, but I'm a little bit skeptical because we have seen, what do you think? Do you reckon we're going to see more stuff attacking OpenOffice?
I'm sure we are. I mean, you know, the downloads keep going up, more people are using it. There's no reason not to attack it, and especially with these cross-platform things as well. You know, you attack OpenOffice. If you get it right, then you're not just hitting Windows people who have switched over to that or started using that. Then you've also got the other platforms open to you as well.
And client-side vulnerabilities are all the rage these days. You know, everyone used to go for the network sort of vulnerabilities. Then, you know, Microsoft spoiled all our fun by putting a firewall, you know, into the OS as part of Service Pack 2. So it seems, you know, Word, PowerPoint, you know, Flash, QuickTime, and I guess OpenOffice. So, you know, we should, and I've heard bad stuff about the open source code repositories of OpenOffice. I've heard it's a bit of a, you know, mess, actually. So there's probably a fairly high number of vulnerabilities in there.
Yeah, I think we're definitely going to see more of these to come.
All right, Munir. Well, on that cheery note, I think we'll leave it for this week, but thank you very much for joining us as always.
It's been a pleasure, mate. Talk to you soon.
We'll be back with McLennan Starkey from OSCERT right after this.
Checkpoint is the worldwide leader in securing the internet. Our focus is purely on IT security. Pure Security ensures customers' protection through unified, reliable and extensible solutions. Learn more about the technology that secures 128 of Australia's top 200 companies at checkpoint.com.
Now it's time to have a chat with OSCERT analyst McLennan Starkey. Now, Mecca, I understand you guys are noticing an increased number of probes on SSH ports.
Absolutely. This week and last week also, we've seen a significant increase in the number of SSH scannings that are coming both into and out of Australia. Now, What's really interesting about this, Patrick, is that it's something that is so simple to mitigate. It doesn't appear to be a vulnerability in the SSH protocol or in anything that that handles the SSH protocol. What it appears to be is standard run-of-the-mill password cracking.
Oh, so this is going beyond just probing. They're just trying some basic passwords, are they?
Absolutely. In just about all of the scans we're seeing, they'll use anywhere up to 200 usernames and password combinations, and it's quite obviously automated.
You reckon they're getting much luck?
I reckon they're probably getting a bit, yes. Which is unfortunate, because the mitigations for this are so incredibly simple. You can, for example, restrict the IPs that are allowed to connect to your SSH server, and you can use public key authentication, which completely negates password-based scanning.
Or you can IP restrict, you know, who's allowed to actually even access that daemon.
You can.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, that attack, it's been around for 20 years, so we hope there's not too many high-value targets getting owned by it, but you never know.
Indeed. Unfortunately, with the ingress and egress of IT staff, a lot of the knowledge seems to go with them, and these things do continue to be a recurring problem.
Okay. Well, one to keep an eye on. If you've got a SSH port open with some default passwords enabled, you might want to get on top of it. I guess the other item that we're discussing this week, Macca, is you've noticed some increasingly sophisticated phishing attacks. Now, you know, phishing, I'm sorry, listeners, because everyone gets sick of hearing about it, but this is kind of interesting, isn't it? Tell us what you got this morning.
It is. This one's actually fairly interesting. It was, and I wouldn't have looked at it except that our automated tools failed to pick up the URL in this particular email. So when I took a look at this seemingly blatant eBay phishing scam, what I noticed right down the very bottom of it was an iframe link off to a couple of servers in China.
So this, I mean, whereas previously you'd have to actually click on a link to get taken to a web server, load up your browser, and then get infected that way, this thing can actually infect a lot of older mail clients automatically, can't it?
Absolutely, it can. And I imagine that it can also infect a number of systems via the webmail clients that they may be using.
Yeah, well, I remember a few years ago there was a problem with the Yahoo webmail where it wouldn't render code unless you sent, you know, a big email. So after 3,000 words or something, it would actually start rendering code. And I think the reason that was discovered was some security researchers were actually bouncing some research back and forth on a different issue and noticed that the code had started rendering. So I guess it just really depends on which webmail service you use or which mail client you use.
That's correct.
So it could affect, I suppose, you know, your lower sort of small end webmail packages, and it could also affect some older versions of things like Outlook Express. Is that right?
Absolutely, it certainly could. Now, what the end goal of these guys appears to be is World of Warcraft passwords.
You serious?
No, absolutely.
Macca, how would one actually, you know, turn World of Warcraft passwords to their benefit financially?
Well, that's really interesting, because once you actually take control of a World of Warcraft character that somebody has spent the last 5 or 6 years building up, you can then sell that to another player or just specific items from a particular character to other players that are significantly involved in the game.
It is a strange world indeed.
It is.
It seems a silly way to wind up in jail, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
Okay, Macca, thank you very much for taking some time out this week.
No problem. Thank you, Patrick.
You're listening to Risky Business, itradio.com.au's weekly security podcast, sponsored by CyberTrust. I'm Patrick Gray. It's time now for this week's feature interview. Our guest this week is Howard Schmidt. He's been around the traps for a long time. He served as Microsoft's Chief Security Officer and eBay's Global Director of Trust and Safety. These days, he's still got his hands full, serving as a special agent for the US Army's Criminal Investigation Command in the Computer Crime Division. He's also a professor at Georgia Tech's College of Computing and a consultant. Now, when you listen to this interview, I should note that a couple of minutes in, there was some mobile interference on the recording. It's annoying, but I didn't want to cut out Howard's comments at that point. Now, when we spoke a few weeks ago, I started by asking Schmidt what his first experience with tracking computer crime was way back in the 80s. As we'll find out, identity theft is hardly a new concept.
Yeah, I think the first one was where people were actually using some of the early credit bureau systems, using a personal computer to log in there and just download all the data, because at that time there were very few, if any, restrictions on it, All you had to do was have a legitimate business license, which you get for $10 US at the time.
So you pass your Dun & Bradstreet, you know, cursory check or something.
Yeah, and they didn't even go that far at that time. All they did was, you know, for example, I was in the state of Arizona. You can apply for a state business license for $10 U.S., and then after that, you have access to the credit reports and all these other things. In this case, it was an individual that was posing as a travel agency and downloading credit reports and using that to do credit card fraud and identity theft.
So, I mean, we're led to believe these days that, you know, ID theft with a computer-involved, you know, element is something new, but what you're saying is it's been around since, when are we talking here, the early 80s?
1986, as a matter of fact. I talked to so many people that everything from, did you hear about this new thing called identity theft, all the way up to a lot of discussions about credit card fraud and carding and things of this nature, which in reality, were over 20 years that this has been going on.
Now, look, I mean, depending on who you're listening to, things are either getting really a lot better or sliding into chaos, you know, into absolute anarchy out there. What's your bead on the current situation, the current state of play, both among, from the point of view of the criminal syndicates and, you know, the people on the defensive side, be they government or corporate?
I think clearly on the defense side, and I'll cover that first, we are now becoming more institutionalized as far as the tools, the technologies, the processes we use to combat all levels of everything from hacking to identity theft to anti-phishing. You look at some of the things that are now built into browsers, that build into the toolbars that are out there that basically help keep the end user away from the criminals. And so if you look at sort of the way that things track, the first place that you get is an email. Well, now we have all these spam filters at all these different levels, so you may not even get the phishing email that results in identity theft in your inbox. If it somehow passes through and you do get it, then you click on it. The next component of that is the fact that the browsers then warn you or alert you, particularly with the new extended verification search where it turns green in the title bar or turns red if it's a fraudulent site. Those then give you a better warning as an end user. The third component is just the awareness. Users have become more aware that I better be more cautious of these things. The downside is actually affecting some issues where they may not buy as much as they'd like to because they're not quite sure whether it's legitimate or not. As far as what's going on the criminal side, we're seeing better organization, a better structure. The same tools that used to be, you know, remember the term we used to use, script kiddies, when it came to hacking tools were out there? The same sort of things are being given in phishing and identity theft. Toolkits are being built, phishing kits that are being built.
Well, we're seeing, you know, Trojans with revision control that were obviously written by teams of coders. I mean, it seems like there are some pretty impressive organizational structures out there among the criminal gangs. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct, and that's the issue we're finding. They're more targeted, they're more specific, and they're more structured than they ever were in the past. We always use the term, familiar with the game whack-a-mole, where it's this little game where this thing pops out of the ground, you have to smack it with a hammer, and it goes down, it pops up somewhere else. For the long time, that's what we've been dealing with, because not knowing, not being any structure out there, these things were popping up, and now with coders that are working directly, doing revision controls, putting the kits together, it puts more structure around it. When you have more structure, you have a better opportunity to go ahead and identify who's doing it, as well as protect against these things.
But aren't they also harder to prosecute and harder to bring actually into the justice system and the judiciary when you've got these really organized? I mean, they run like the mafia. Taking down the mob has proved a tad tricky over the years.
It is. If they had the same resources as the traditional mob, I mean, that would be the case. But in this case, these are people that are somewhat new to the criminal enterprise. It's not as if they've got 200 years of experience of running an organized crime issue. What we're seeing now is what used to be the cyber crime units of some law enforcement agency are now becoming part of an organized crime or commercial crimes unit, which look at it at a much higher level than just going out and attacking people one at a time, trying to stop them from what they're doing. Now, the issue that you raised the question about, isn't it more difficult to catch them and prosecute them? It takes more resources, but it also gives you a better reward at the end of it. And we go back to, as you and I were talking a few minutes ago, about some of the early days of criminals that may or may not should have been doing the time for they're doing. Now these people are doing serious crimes because it's no longer about breaking in just for the fun of it. They're actually doing serious damage to the economy and people's lives.
Now, when we last spoke or last met face to face, that would have been about 4 years ago. And, you know, we were discussing Microsoft's plan to sort of start automatic updates for operating systems. And really, it was the wild, wild west out there on the internet. The last days of the fully open net. But you think, you know, 4 years later, things would have got better, but we're still seeing these massive data breaches, aren't we? When are we going to start to see these massive compromises disappearing?
Well, there's a couple things. I think what we're seeing is we're seeing more value in a certain compromise. And I think this week is the one-week anniversary of the missing laptop with the 25,000 or 25 million veterans records from the U.S. It's been 1 year since that's taken place, and we still see it all the time. We're more cognizant of it. There's more laws that are requiring the people to identify these things taking place. But clearly, what we don't talk about is the literally hundreds of thousands of other systems that are not being breached. We always talk, you know, and the illustration I use.
But we don't care about them, do we?
We don't. And that's the neat part about it. It's an interesting piece about it. Because I'll take Sydney, for example, and I'm down there. When you look at the morning news, you look about the traffic jams, the accidents on the motorways, and we'll report that. They never report that 450,000 people successfully drove to work today. So consequently, it doesn't have the same grip and grasp that says, oh, gee, we've had, you know, 5,000 university students now whose data has potentially been compromised. And that's the issue. When you look at the privacyrights.org site, and I think we're up over 120 million records that potentially have been exposed, you look at the raw number of people that actually have been impacted by it, it's much, much smaller than that.
But don't you think sometimes that we need a fundamental rethink if these breaches are obviously so easy? I'll give you an example. You know, do you know Steve Manzik?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I was having a beer with Steve Manzik the other night, and I said to him, you know, things have got worse. He disagreed. He said, oh, no, you know, they haven't got worse. I said, okay, Steve, if I ask you to, could you go out tonight, right now, up to your hotel room, and then bring me down 50,000 credit card numbers by tomorrow, if you were so inclined? And he took a sip on his beer, and he thought about it, and he said, absolutely.
Sure.
We're battling the same issues that we were battling 5 years ago. Don't you think it's time for a fundamental rethink of the way that we do this stuff?
And one, I don't disagree with that. The question is how viable are those credit card numbers? How long will they be used? And what impact it would be on you and I as the people that own those credit cards? And that's what it's all about, is the impact it has on us as individuals. Back in the days, we used to have credit card number generators for American Express and Visa. We used to download those from bulletin boards and create all the cards. Oftentimes, they had a life expectancy of less than an hour because then they started building the extra controls. So clearly, that data is still out there, but the impact is much lower right now. The other thing I think is important to recognize is we need to fundamentally, and you hit on this correctly, we need to fundamentally look at the way we do identity management in today's society. In the U.S., for example, I gave a speech here a week or so back at a conference, and I said what we should do is take everyone in the U.S., take their Social Security number, their date of birth, their credit card number, and post it on the Internet. And then declare at that moment, no longer would this be used for identification purposes. That sort of takes all the benefit out of the criminals using it and come up with another system.
But, I mean, this would require some sort of federated identity solution, and that requires cooperation between government and private enterprise. And pretty much every analyst that I've spoken to and you know, senior people within financial institutions have said, hey, look, buddy, off the record, it's never going to happen.
And I don't think it's a matter of it never will happen. It's just taken a lot longer than we'd hoped it would have. We've seen some spots out of, for example, in U.S. defense, we all have these what they call the CAC, combination access cards, that are the military ID, have the certificate on there, expires every 3 years. So we effectively have within the defense forces the ability to do something like that. And of course, there's mine.
It's a smart card with a private key on it.
That's correct. And what happens is now we're eventually working to the point where no longer will user ID be available. You must use the smart card. So consequently, you have a stronger level of authentication.
But it's still two-factor. It's still quite basic. You don't know what you're actually authenticating because that card can't tell you what it is that you're giving approval to do. You might be buying some cat food when you put your PIN in, or you might be opening a door. Don't you think we need to take that level of identity management to something sophisticated, maybe some sort of sophisticated cryptographic hardware that we wind up with in our cell phone so that we know what we're authenticating, we can have it pop up. Do we want to do this? It gives us a specific action. Do you want to transfer $500 to evilhackers.ru? Yes or no? Sort of where we're headed, because with all of these two-factor solutions, whether they're tokens, whether they're smart cards, they can all be messed with.
Yeah, and that's the issue. Is it better than user ID and password? Absolutely. Is it the end state and the panacea? Absolutely not. You have the man-in-the-middle attacks on one-time passwords. I have an application on my mobile where I can generate a one-time password in addition to a PIN number that I use. Once again, that may be subject to a man-in-the-middle attack. Yeah, but clearly we need to continue to look to moving to a more digital identity environment that basically takes all the things that we know that can be compromised, and the key word is the things that we know at this time how it can be compromised and build to that level. But you're correct. It has governments have got to do it. I mean, we've got – I remember when NOAA in Australia I don't know if you remember John Rimmer when he was the director of NOAA. But John had a really good – you know, he and I were keen to look at a digital identity, you know, from cradle to grave. That's something that you have the ability. If I want to pick up a new mobile phone, they have to do a credit report. You can use my information. I can, you know, vet it to you for 30 minutes. And then it's no longer in your system anymore. So I actually exercise more control. We are now working. There's a number of task force, both in the U.S. and other places around the world, that are looking at ID management, not just the technology, but also the political process, the government relationships, the private sectors, and how we as a society, from a social point, will no longer depend on this piece of paper that has a photograph on it that can be so easily changed and forged as we can do things.
That was Howard Schmidt there. Next up, it's time for our sponsor interview. Risky Business would not exist without the financial support of CyberTrust, so each week we have one of their consultants on the podcast to talk about a hot-button issue. This week we're talking to CyberTrust's Paul Nevin about forensics. As it turns out, some anti-forensics tricks the bad guys are using these days involve explosives, not just low-level formats. So, Paul, what is new in forensics? Because it seems to be a discipline that's remained fairly static over the last few years.
Yeah, IT forensics is still a relatively new field in IT. I mean, people have been doing it for the last 10 years or so, but it hasn't really seen common adoption. IT forensics has had a lot more acceptance, especially in the States where compliance has started to necessitate the inclusion of IT forensics as part of the checklist of that requirement, if you like.
Well, I guess you've got to make sure that your machines are actually ready for a forensic analysis in the first place if something does go wrong.
Well, corporate forensics is one field, and that's the compliance really drives that. But forensics as part of law enforcement, as part of the investigation, has seen a lot of success. It's very hard for a suspect to argue about the evidence presented to them when it's collected from their PC.
But I guess one of the problems here is when we're dealing with computers and we're dealing with the judiciary, it becomes quite time-intensive and it becomes quite expensive, doesn't it, because it's a specialist field.
It is. There are a lot of challenges in IT forensics, but usually the outcomes, the ability to present evidence of high value to a court, it has a very positive effect on the investigation and is seen as instrumental in getting the conviction.
Yeah. No, I guess it would be what is primarily relied on, because you're dealing with a, you know, virtual crime scene, aren't you? There's no fingerprints you can look at. It's all got to be logs and whatnot.
That's right. And the investigators have to be mindful of the type of crime that they're investigating. They have to consider how to best collect the evidence, and there's a number of different places that they can look, and it only comes through experience that they can source the best evidence.
Now, I mean, is it possible that you can actually get irrefutable forensic evidence in a computer crime, or is there a chance that you could actually, you know, if you were a crafty attacker, fit someone up for the crime, sort of plant
evidence? Computer
evidence
is very rarely seen as irrefutable evidence, if you like. It's more often seen as evidence or support an argument. So the prosecution may claim that the evidence discovered demonstrates that the user was performing a particular activity, and therefore, if they can convince the jury, they'll get a conviction. So it's never really irrefutable digital evidence as such.
Now, before we started this interview, you mentioned something about booby traps in the context of forensics.
Booby trapping or counter forensics field isn't new. I mean, people have been doing it for some time, trying to destroy log data, destroy evidence of their activities when they're perpetrating crimes through computers. Over recent years, we've seen the UN weapons inspection team having forensic examiners to go into battlefields to try and retrieve evidence from computers. And they, of course, are trained for explosives and other ordnance inside computers that might be there to destroy the evidence. Fortunately, it's pretty rare, but counter forensics certainly is something that an investigator must be aware of when they're performing investigations.
So we're not talking about a low-level format here, are we? We're talking about actually having a little chunk of C4 embedded in a laptop to...
Yeah, and thankfully, again, we don't see that very often. It's usually counter forensics, for most people, is a matter of destroying data or using encryption or possibly using disk scrubbing software that forensically erases the hard drive. But we can get evidence from ISPs and network data that are enough to produce a brief bit of evidence for that argument in court.
Okay, so, you know, the thermite's not quite in vogue yet.
Grateful to say no.
Okay, Paul, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Patrick.
Well, that's it for another edition of Risky Business. We update every Tuesday, so don't forget to subscribe via iTunes or another podcatcher. Thanks for listening.